I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. The year is 1974. The album Holes in Mellow Rolls. The artist Gabe Kaplan, and my guest this week is Wayne Fetterman. Thank you so much for being here, Wayne.
I'm thrilled to be here. I just want everyone to know that we went through quite the obstacle course to get to this album. Why don't you tell us about it a little?
Well, maybe I provided you with some confusing information. A, I don't know that I sent you my list of records I own first off, which I should have just done.
You sent me the episodes of what people had done.
Yes, I did do that. And then you picked a bunch of really good choices, like stuff that I have wanted to buy in the past and have never bought, including like a good Flip Wilson record.
Well, you've done Flip Wilson before, so I noticed some people, but not this
exactly album. And that happens to be one of the ones we haven't covered that I also don't own, which was just a pain. And I couldn't find. Normally, people have uploaded like every record possible on YouTube.
That's shocking to me.
The ones you picked were the ones that weren't up there.
This is You Devil You, and it was very... We're not doing it. We're about to do Gabe Kaplan.
Right, but we can talk about it.
It's very influential for me because... These are all like my high school when I decided, made the decision, I think I may want to be a comedian for your own life. So I was really into it. And there was two routines on that record, one called Ugly Baby and the other one called Herman something, Herman's Berry. And they were both like long form stories. And they were just great. And I would do them in school and no one knew about them. And anyway, it doesn't matter. There was a movie called Crazy Mary, Crazy Larry or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And in the middle of the film broke. And so for some reason, I walked down to the front of the theater and the ushers, back then they had ushers, put lights on me with their flashlights, and I did one of those bits
while they were
fixing the projector. It was like it's like something out of the movies. Like one of my earliest stand-up gigs in a Plantation movie theater in Florida, watching I cannot remember the name of this movie. It's like Crazy Larry and something Mary. I don't know.
Dirty Mary, anyway. Crazy Larry.
What's it called?
Dirty Mary, Crazy
That's
Larry.
That's it. Dirty.
Peter Fonda.
So now we know the move. Now we know the year of that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for doing the research.
Happy to
Dirty be. Mary. That's what it was in Crazy Larry. Okay. What an insane. Maybe they should, like that's something Tarantino would remake that.
Oh,
week.
Absolutely.
So anyways, so that was one of the albums I wanted to do. You don't have it in your... Oh, you have over 500 albums, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's incredible.
It happens to not be in there. But, you know, I know a couple other guys who make a big point to point out to me, you know, I've got a few thousand. I'm like, well, that's exciting. And I'm sure they own it. I'm sure they own it somewhere.
I didn't mean to make fun of you. I think 500 is amazing. Amazing.
No, I think it's an obsessive level of collection. I shouldn't have 500. It's fine.
Right.
I'm not making
right.
Fun
it's of a, and no. By the way, are you still in the same? Because the last time we did this, where we did the Victor Borger record.
Yes.
I was like at your apartment.
Yes.
Are you still in that same place or have you moved or what?
Same
How
place.
Long ago was that?
That was, I don't know, 6 years ago maybe would be my guess. Yeah, still in the same apartment. Although now we've got nicer equipment and we have a dedicated room. You're not just sitting on my fucking couch, which was... So the first 4 years of this show were on my couch and I felt kind of weird about it. But
and I know it's sort of coming to a close. I'm very curious about your show as much as this album. We're going to get to Gabe Kaplan in a second. But no, I had the best time. I didn't seem thrilled to be doing your show.
I think you did. I was honored because, you know, you're one of those guys who's been in a little bit of everything that I enjoy and sometimes playing versions of yourself where I was just like weirdly fascinated with your career as much as I was your opinions on Victor Borga, which I did not expect you to pick. And I was excited that you picked Victor Borga because no one else had.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was great. I had a great time doing it. It was fun. And obviously I'm a old-time comedy nerd, but the other two albums that you don't have in your collection, and again, I'm not trying to make you feel bad, Oh, was fine. This album. I don't have it anymore, but it was by, do you have any idea if I said the Longines Symphonette, would that mean anything to you? Would it, explain to the kids what that is.
I can only loosely come up with an idea of what it actually meant, because I've got a couple, but they seem like to be lengthy collections of, pardon me, shit that already existed or was in the public domain that they made sound pretty. That's the rough idea that I always got. They're just big, chunky collections of a lot of stuff. Like, I have a Longines Symphonette Christmas compilation that's like,
right, and it's music.
Three or four LPs, yeah.
It's music, right?
Yeah.
So obviously, I don't know what a symphonette is. I thought it was a symphony, but it's not. Maybe it's a small symphony. And so they would put out these records. Sometimes they'd advertise them on television. Mm-hmm. And they got into, during the 70s comedy boom, they got into the comedy record. And they put out a big compilation album. But they also did like a greatest hits of this four-record Longines Symphonette, which had like an incredible lineup of comedians, because it would have like Jack Benny and it also have Joan Rivers. It was like, it really spanned. And at the time, you know, I'm a big radio guy, obviously.
Sure.
And so that was the Longines Symphonette. It was called the Kings of Comedy years before all those four guys, D.L. Hughley, Bernie Mac, became the original Kings of Comedy.
Right.
The Longines Symphonette was doing that years before those guys even probably started doing comedy.
Right. Oh, this is a crazy list. I'm looking at the actual like list of people who are on here. Fuck's sake, this makes no sense, though.
It no sense.
Woody Woodbury is on there along with, I believe, Ernie Kovacs. What the shit? That is, okay.
It's an insane, and sometimes it's just like a minute of somebody's routine. It's a sort of it's a sampler. It's, do you remember the Whitman sampler, the chocolate?
Yeah.
It's like the Whitman sampler. I thought that would be so fun to go through this. Yeah, it's really George Burns, I think, hosted or introduces it. So I loved that record. Again, I'm into old, like Weber and Field. I'm into old comedians.
Yeah.
So before my time.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so that one you didn't have. First of all, I love the name Longines Symphonette.
Sure, like, it's fantastic.
That's who are the. And then the last one was the Edgar Bergen George Garabella album.
Mm-hmm.
Which was very influential. I'm sure there was a time I was very embarrassed that I would started as a ventriloquist.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've come to embrace it a little more because everyone thinks it's goofy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so that was the Bergen record. And he was doing pre-Dice Clay nursery rhymes.
Uh-huh.
That's what I kind of wanted to bring up. So he was doing, there was an old woman who lived in the shoe. And then Charlie would say something kind of off color, or not off color, but I mean slightly, like had so many children, she didn't know when to stop. Like, I remember that was one of the jokes.
Okay.
And then he went like, no, she didn't know what to do. And he went, I think she did. You know, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. So it was pretty ahead of its time.
Uh-huh.
So those are the ones I wanted to do. And then we end up with another influential album of mine. Let's get right to it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, quickly on the Edgar Bergen one.
Yeah, please.
In the 70s, they started, and I'm very lucky that this happened because I was a nerd for this stuff. They started releasing old radio shows on albums, right? Do you know when the first of that was? You're more of an expert than I am.
No, I'm really not. I only know what I've found, and I've got a few of those. I'm fascinated by them, but I've got, like, you know, Duffy's Tavern and some other shit that I'd never heard of because I just grabbed it if I saw it. But, you know, it's clearly, obviously, early 70s. And some of them still had the old, we're still possibly even sponsored by the original sponsors, where it's like Maxwell House realizes they own this Burns and Allen bit, so they just fucking release a record. I think that might have been what was happening.
Wow, because Chase and Sanborn, that was a coffee. Is that still around, by the way?
I don't think so. I know what it is, though, so it couldn't have gone away too long ago, right? I don't know.
I don't know. So they have been sponsoring radio since the very beginning, but they were big, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, who I think we're the last big act to have a network radio show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for who, they were in the 30s, and he went all the way to, I'm going to say, 56.
Wow.
Like, that is, like, really deep into the television era.
Mm-hmm.
And, so he was, I think, the last one to. Anyway, so this one, this album, Holes and Mellow Rose, which has two album covers. He has the original one.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. You can say. I want you to jump in. I feel like I'm talking too much.
Are you kidding? No, I like listening. No, well, yeah, there are two record covers. The other, the first is what I assume a Mellow Roll is, which is the ice cream that he's talking
yes.
about.
Yes, yep, yep.
And the second one is obviously post-Cotter, but it also has a different track listing. So if
if
you remember the original, which you may well, which with the first cover, the one I have and have ripped to MP3 is the Sweat Hog version, and it is slightly different.
Oh, right. I mean, barely. He starts, well, they would say, up your nose with a Mellow Roll. That was part of one of his punchlines. He was reminiscing about his growing up and people having insults back and forth.
Yeah.
And so that was like, and that literally became the template for Welcome Back, Cotter. Am I right?
I mean, absolutely. There's one character that is obviously there's two characters. He names Epstein and Horshack, who obviously become characters on the show. He has his own interpretations of them. I can't think of another record that is so obviously the template for a show, though, either. Like, you know, you could be like, listen to like an early Ray Romano thing and be like, yeah, sure, he's talking about his wife and his family or whatever, but this is very specific.
In terms of, is there anything close to that? You have 500 albums,
right? Not what do you, none of them that I own that are that obvious, except for if you want to make the leap that obviously Bob Newhart's bits were all on the phone, and he starts his first episode of the Bob Newhart Show on the phone. And
oh, he does.
You know, yeah, he does.
Are you like talking about the 1970s Bob Newhart? Did you know there was another Bob Newhart Show?
Of course, that's the one I grew up with, and then I just
no. Wait, I'm talking about the one in the 60s.
There's one in the 60s. What the fuck are we talking about? Please,
explain. Yeah, there was a Bob Newhart Show. I don't think I've ever seen it.
Okay,
and if I'm not mistaken, I think it won an Emmy Award got canceled the same year.
Wow.
I don't go on the computer when I'm doing podcasts.
Sure.
Can you look that up?
For us, yeah.
I'm guessing 62 is my guess.
Wow. I mean, very early into the career.
I think it was called the Bob Newhart Show.
Okay, so let's see here.
What do we have?
Is it going to take me forever to find it? Or it's not Bob Newhart Show, Bob Newhart Show. Wait, what is this one? Okay, hold on. Yeah, 1961 and 2.
One?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So is it a variety show?
I think there was a variety, and I think there was also a sitcom thing that he did a couple things.
Okay.
Because he was so popular, obviously, and I know you've had to. How many people have done the button-down mind of Bob Newhart?
Oh, God, I don't even know. Probably a dozen would be my guess.
That record is so incredible.
Yeah.
And just because it's his first nightclub performance
as well. Yeah, that's the most annoying part of it.
Not inspiring. Not aspirational.
No, fuck you, Bob Newhart. That's not good. Stop being
He's the opposite of 10,000 Hours. They should have Bob Newhart.
Yep.
Who's the guy that wrote that book?
Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell on a side-by-side, like the showdown, the fight of the century. He's like, oh, I did this in 8 hours. Not 10,000. I don't think I got to double digits in hours before I released an album, a comedy album, that went to number one in the country for 14 weeks.
Oh, Jesus.
I love that you're mad at Bob Newhart for that.
Yeah, it's a positive kind of mad, though. I'm
jealous. I understand.
Very jealous.
Of course. He's so good. So anyway, we're talking about comedy routines that might have become sitcoms.
Yeah.
I didn't even think I was going to be talking about this today,
but
I'm trying to think if there's, I guess, even Freddie Prinze, that's like, he's a Hispanic kid, you know, Chico and the Man, but it's not like he was talking about that at all.
Right.
Or even Jimmy Walker with the, you know, Kid Dynamite or anything like that. I don't think.
No, I feel like he's one of those guys who leaned into it after the sitcom took off and that, you know, then names a record that and, you know.
What about Seinfeld? What about Seinfeld? No, not really. He did observational material.
Yeah, it's always just personality where it's like, oh, Red Fox sounds and looks like this. Let's make him own a fucking, you know, junkyard and then Bob's your uncle. Like, it's always personality. Rarely is it material, like specific material that turns into a show. I could be wrong. Somebody could correct me. Like, no, there's a million shows, but I don't know. In my experience, no.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. I'm thinking, So anyway, so again, Horseshack is in the routine. Mm-hmm. Before there is an Arnold Horseshack and that actor, or Boom Boom Washington, or what was the Travolta's character on that? Vinny Barbarino?
Thank you, Barbarino. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Couldn't remember.
So, okay. So I know the album. I listened to the album. I really like his style. Mm-hmm. And here's some crazy, crazy Gabe Kaplan trivia. Okay. When he started out, he played strip clubs.
Uh-huh.
He started out really young. He played strip clubs in up and down on the East Coast. One of the strip clubs was in Dallas, Texas, owned by a guy named Jack Ruby. He played that strip club, I think at the Star something, whatever it's called,
mm-hmm.
a couple months before the assassination. Hung out with Jack Ruby. There was like a regular house, like MC, like strip. This is the part of, if I can criticize my book, because I just have a book called The History of Stand-Up, I would say that's the area of the book that I wish I had written more about, was kind of the strip club circuit.
Oh, yeah,
it was like, it sort of came out of burlesque and then went all the way into the 80s. I mean, mm-hmm. Jay Leno worked at strip clubs.
Yeah.
So they were using comedians in strip clubs. It seems ridiculous, right? I don't know. Have you ever been to a strip club?
No, I've not.
But you know kind of what it is.
Of course I know, sure.
Yeah. So anyway, in a way, Gabe, and I talked to him, and he was like, if the mafia hires this guy, Jack Ruby, to be their hitman, to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, he would have been the last guy they hired. He just seemed like this goofy guy who was running a strip club. So how crazy is that?
That's fucking nuts, honestly. I was going to ask if you had met / interviewed. Did you know him before the book? I'm assuming. You know everybody, so I'm assuming.
I don't know everyone. Yes, I knew him before the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have another Gabe Kaplan, Wayne Fetterman connection.
Okay.
And so anyway, I'm in
play. I have a third, by the way, once you do this.
No, you do yours. Again, I feel like I'm talking way too much.
No, it's just a connection. It's a connection between you and Welcome Back, Cotter, and it has to do with guest starring on a particular show. Do you have any idea what show you guest starred on that a sweat hog, a former sweat hog, also guest starred on?
Oh, my God. I love it. Okay. Wayne Fetterman trivia done by Wayne Fetterman.
Mm-hmm.
God,
I'll give you a hint. It's the subject of my other podcast, but if you don't know what that is, then that won't give it away.
Is it an X-Files?
No. Although that is a great X-Files. It is a very good X-Files.
No. Was it on the same episode?
No, it was not. It might have been the same season. Watch it be a show you forgot you were ever on.
No. I remember, there's one show I don't remember taping of all the ones I've done. Like, I have a very good memory for this stuff.
Okay.
Can you tell me the year?
I can look up the year that you were on it. Absolutely.
Hold on. Yeah.
Let's look up Wayne Fetterman's IMDb. while I do this, tell them the name of your book and where they can find it.
Oh, okay. Guys, I really am not good at selling things. It's called, I'm looking at it right now, The History of Stand-Up. From Mark Twain to Dave Chappelle, and it's just, I tell the whole story, how it all started. A lot of people think it started with Mort Saul. A lot of people think stand-up started with Richie Pryor. No, people were doing stand-up, or how we define stand-up, way before then, including people like Bob Hope and Will Rogers, Bert, and a guy named Artemus Ward. So it's... If you're into stand-up, you might find this book interesting.
I'm excited to read it once I pick up a copy.
You are?
I need to do that. Yeah, of course. I'm always interested in this stuff, and it might be, you know, one of those that I actually don't put down because sometimes I have a problem finishing books. This one's of interest, and I also love... I think I didn't find out about it except for Katie Mears. Katie Mears told me about it, who's been on the show a few times, and she was like, oh, yeah, Wayne's got this new book coming out. I'm like, oh, fuck. All right, good. I'm excited to hear about it.
Yeah, she is so good.
She's
I love
annoyingly
that.
Smart. Again, it's the same feeling I have about Bob Newhart. I'm fucking annoyed that she's that smart. It's all right. It's okay.
I acknowledge her in the book. She actually helped me with some stuff.
Amazing.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. And she's what? She's 16? How old is
she? I know, right? Basically. The year's 1999 that you appeared on this particular show. I had forgotten what season you were on, but.
99?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I have
it's
no.
It's a sitcom.
A sitcom in 99?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
News radio.
Oh!
Yeah.
Yes.
You were on a season. I forgot it was a season 5 episode, but Robert Hedges, I think the season the before maybe, plays one of Joe Rogan's older brothers.
Oh, he does. Oh, that's awesome. Yes.
Yeah. And it's honestly a great underrated quick appearance where he plays a priest with a baseball bat under his cloth. It's fucking fantastic. It's a good bit.
Yes.
There we go.
That's the post Hartman year, right?
Yeah. 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 Underrated, honestly. If I'm fair about that
season or the whole show?
The whole show, yes. But that of us nerds, like 4 News Radio, it happens to be like that season gets shit on because Phil Hartman's not there. And I get it. I totally get it. But I think it's better than they give it credit for.
It's
a good season. It's good. And you're good on it. It's
fun. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes, News Radio. Yeah. So good.
We are. You have another story about our good friend, Kaplan.
And it also ties into what I was talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
which is Edgar Bergen. So anyway, I'm in high school. I'm making this decision, this life decision that I might want to become a comedian and an actor.
Mm-hmm.
Comedian who can also act was the goal.
Sure.
So I start doing ventriloquism in high school again. I'm sure you know, I went to South Plantation High School. I'm from Plantation, Florida. I'm from the less progressive part of Plantation. I'm from the south part of a place called Plantation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already, draw your own conclusions. But because it's just north of Miami, I get to see some comedian. I start going to, like, a lot of my friends are like, oh, I'm going to go see Led Zeppelin in Tampa. I'm going to go see the Allman Brothers in Miami at the Sportatorium. I'm going to go to Pirates World and see Joe Walsh. I'm like, I'm going to see Jackie Mason playing in his little club. I'm going to see Gabe Kaplan at the Playboy Club. And we're taping this on Mother's Day. I go with my mom. How crazy is that? My mom and I, we drive down to Miami, and I think it's in North Miami, the Playboy Club. It's $5 cover charge, no minimum, to see Gabe Kaplan. And he'd already, I think it was maybe the beginning of the show or it just started, mm-hmm. and I had known him from the Midnight Special, the Tonight Show, and so he basically does the album. He basically does Holes and Mellow Rolls. His big closer, of course, is his Ed Sullivan bit, where he does Ed Sullivan if he got drunk on the last show and what he really thought about all the acts. And it's just a great, I don't even know if you could do the routine anymore because he's like, because he was just talking about like how Sullivan did something for the kids and then something for the Jews and something for the Italians. And mm-hmm. It was just great. So he closed with that. And then I met him afterwards. And I've spoken to him since about it. He doesn't remember me at all. But he was very encouraging and very nice. And so that was like first or second time I'd ever been in a nightclub in my life. I must have been 16.
Okay.
So, and they let you in. Like, you just couldn't buy alcohol. And so we, you know. My mom and I went down to see him at the Playboy Club.
Did your mom know that this was like a thing that you were looking at doing? Or did she?
Yeah.
So she understood it wasn't just, I want to go entertain myself. I kind of want to be a comedian.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think she actually encouraged me to go up to him afterwards and tell him and ask for advice or something.
Yeah.
And then, the next year, or around the same time, Edgar Bergen, right at the end of his life, Bergen dies in, what, 76?
Mm-hmm.
So this is 74, maybe. I see him at, oh, it's so heartbreaking. So heartbreaking. I mean, there was something called the condo circuit, where these performers would play. So it was inside like a condominium hotel ballroom.
Okay.
Maybe 50 people were there.
Oh, okay.
And he's, you know, he's got to be in his 80s, sure. Right?
Sure.
And he's doing the act, and he does Charlie, and then he does Mortimer, and then he does like a Red Skelton type pantomime thing where he's sitting on a porch, okay? And then there's like maybe sound effects, and he like waves at people, like an old guy sitting on the porch. So, but then the chair that he's sitting on like breaks. So poor Edgar Birkin. Oh my God. And then he gets up and they fix the chair and he kind of goes on. And it was really, I mean, I loved seeing Charlie Bay. I didn't come up to him after the show or anything like that. It was like, felt like he had a tough enough night.
Uh-huh.
Not dealing with a young, stupid Wayne Fetterman. So,
oh boy.
So that's why these comedians are very important to me.
Of course.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be I feel bad. I'm not.
No, of course. That's what you have a sense of humor for. Like, that's what we do in this comedian. We laugh at tragedy. So it's, he didn't die. He didn't break his neck or anything. Sure. That would have been terrible.
Sure.
But I still have the ticket. And I think the price of that show, no drink minimum, nothing. $3
fuck.
To see Edgar Bergen, one of the biggest stars in radio.
Uh-huh.
$3.
Yeah.
What if it would be free at that point? It was like,
is there any truth to the rumor that he had a room just for Charlie McCarthy?
Well, it is true. I mean, okay. From what I understand, it is true, but that's also because, and I know it was supposedly bigger than Candace Bergen's room.
Yeah.
There was a little controversy about that. But the fact is, it wasn't just for Charlie. It was for Charlie, and then he had Mortimer, and then he had this full length. He had an Effie Clinker, which was this female, like, I know there was this character back then, like the old maid, like the woman that couldn't get married and stuff. So that was Effie Clinker. And then he also had like a full length, like, dummy that he would sort of dance with and talk to, you know? Can you kind of picture that?
I can, and it's creeping me out.
Yeah, they're sort of holding on, but one of the arms is fake, and it goes around Edgar. And anyway, so we had all of that stuff in a big room.
Sure.
So it wasn't just like Charlie's in a bed, in a huge bed.
That's what I picture, for
sure. Of course, with like maid service going on.
And a little teary-eyed Candace Bergen. Like, Bergen, what the fuck do I have to do? Oh, good God. Okay. Well, that makes me feel a little
better. Can I do? I know we're not supposed to talk about, but that album that you don't have, the George Gabrarian, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name. I don't know who that guy was.
Oh, wait. I know. It's Garabedian, I think. And I'm Garabedian, trying to remember what else I'll look it up. But
No,
we can talk about whatever. We're talking about the history of stand-up. So,
okay. So on that album, the Chase and Sanborn, the first one that he put out, which is the best. Mm-hmm. He put out a couple with Edgar Bergen on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a routine from the radio show when Candace Bergen is 6 years old and she comes on the radio show.
Oh, my God.
And it is one of the most well-conceived bits of comedy structure I've ever... Because the whole bit, and I guess now that I'm looking back on it, I guess there's a psychological element to it, was that Charlie was jealous of Candace and didn't want her in the act at all. So it was like, and this is my daughter, Candace. Hi, Daddy. And she's like, say hi to Charlie. Hi, Charlie. He's like, okay, that's very good, you little girl. Like, it was like just completely dismissive. And then they do, I think they do like the night before Christmas. And then they do Sunny Boy. It's just incredible. I love the writing on that show. Mm-hmm. I know no one cares about Edgar Bergen, for the main reason is he was a ventriloquist on the radio. And it's like being a juggler on the radio, right? Or a mime on the radio. No one cares.
But people ate it up, though. That's,
they
that's
ate
the
it
difference.
Up. Yes. Because the characterization was that good. But still, the idea of it is absurd, right?
Uh-huh.
So that was also on that album that I would have loved to listen to that track with you. Yeah. But
well,
again,
I will now have to buy it. It doesn't cost that much. I will have to buy it. And
it's the best one if you want to get. I mean, he does the poems. He does the Candace Bergen one. Mm-hmm. So what is the guy's name? Is it George?
It is George Garabedian. I'm trying to see. Yeah. He has credits on almost 200 different albums. So he worked on everything.
Who was he? Can you find out what that?
All it says is Southern California musician, producer, and founder of Mark 56 Records. Although I didn't look up his Wikipedia. He may well have a lengthier.
Right.
Nope. Not a whole lot. Just information at Grammy.com. What does Grammy.com tell me? Nothing. Nothing. Just that he's nominated a few times for different records.
For what?
Okay.
Give me an example of a record.
1978. Best historical repackage album. The first recorded sounds, 1888 to 1929.
Oh,
actually,
so
I actually would buy that. I would buy that, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
All historical or historical reissues. Early history of the phonograph record with Thomas Alva Edison. And then world's first entertainment recordings, 1889 to 1896. And this
Wait. What was the first album was from 1880?
These records came out in 78, 80, and 84, respectively. And the first one is entitled The First Recorded Sounds, 1888 to 1929. And that is pretty early in the history of recorded
sounds. No, because in my book, I'm tying it into the book.
Yes.
I talk about a comedian that no one knows about called Marshall P. Wilder. I'm sure you've never heard of him.
If he did, well, hold on. No, because did he record on Cylinder? Is he one of those guys?
Yes, he did. He was an early comedian on that, but even more important than that. Yes, he had a very ahead of his time. He had a routine from 1906 called Stories About the Baby, and he starts out with this sentence. Because at the time, how would you describe this? When they would sort of set up those old records, they would go, and now Marshall P. Wilder, Stories About the Baby, you know?
Yeah.
So after that little introduction, he goes, have you ever noticed like a very 80s kind of comedy trope?
Love it.
In 1906, have you ever noticed?
That's fantastic.
Yeah. But anyway, I did some research about this guy, and apparently in 1888, and maybe George will now help me with this, he recorded in New York City, supposedly the first comedy ever recorded.
Okay, this is something I've been trying to dig into. I'm glad you dug into it. Hit me.
Yeah,
right,
let's
please.
Do it. Yeah, this is at the Electric Club, which was in the 20s, like near Gramercy Park in New York City. Alva Edison is doing a big press demonstration of his newest recording device. And he has a singer, he has a thing, and he has Marshall P. Wilder, who's one of the top comedians in 1888, do a comedy routine. And then he does it in front of the press, and then they play it right back. And so that's the first, I don't know what bit he did.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if it's, as far as I know, that bit doesn't exist anymore, but
probably.
Maybe.
They probably fucking, I mean,
maybe
back
George
then they would wipe
him.
Over him. That's the other problem. That's
they
the
did?
Problem.
Tell me about it. What,
sometimes,
what
well, if, I would, I don't know if it was just in the sake, for the sake of, okay, you know, here, I'm going to correct myself. So many of those were actually built for dictaphones. You know, dictaphone was first a cylinder situation. So the situation there was, I'll tell my secretary what to write down, and then when she's done, you scrape off a layer as it goes, and then you reuse it. I don't know if they did that for entertainment stuff. They might have tried to keep it, but I should.
Okay.
I mean, I should look it up. I'm assuming you tried to find the recording and found.
I did. I couldn't find it. I couldn't.
That
I mean,
sucks. Damn it.
I would love, but that. I have the data. Oh, well, let me look it up in the book. Hold it. Give me one second.
Sure.
I'm looking it
no,
up.
No, I love that. Because I was, for a while, researching like the history of recorded sketch, and I wanted to find the first. I found like the earliest recorded sketch that I could find. That doesn't mean it's the earliest it was ever made, but I love that you dug into what seems to be the first recorded comedy ever, because that's. And I've also been, like, on my own, been writing, like, fake history of my own comedy group that now goes back to 1860 for no reason, and trying to make it so that we've done the first comedy.
Right,
in,
I love
in
it.
Any,
I love
you know,
it, love
just
it.
Like, but nobody knows about it because blah blah blah. You know, that's a fun way to fuck with history. But, I want to know actually.
Okay, here it is.
Yes,
here it is. Sorry.
No.
It was May 12th, 1888.
Wow.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was in the New York Times, and it was also in, like, there was, like, a magazine called, like, Electronic World or something like that, you know, sure. Like one of those things. That, yeah, May 12th, 1888. So in New York City. And
what were your...
But it was also a point. The point I wanted to make was that here's a comedian no one's ever heard of, including myself, until I really did this, like Marshall P. Wilder. And yet at the time, Alva Edison was like, that's the guy I want doing comedy.
Yeah.
That's how popular he was in 1888.
Mm-hmm. This guy has a demented face, Marshall P. Wilder.
Well, okay, first of all, he was a hunchback dwarf. He was just stop making fun of
him. I'm not making fun of him. I'm talking about what I'm looking at is the evolution of a laugh, which is him frowning
and making
the creepiest smile I've ever seen. I won't judge his resting him face. I'll leave that to the mean people. But yeah. This is fascinating.
So he was a disabled guy, and just incredible story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna have to look up that.
Women be shopping. That's what would blow my mind is if that was one of his. What were your this might be boring to some people, but not to me.
Right.
What were your research resources? Was it how much did you pull from your brain and then go from, or like where did you start raw in terms of like looking at comedy?
Well, the book came out of an article I had. I mean, I've been into this obviously since I saw Edgar Bergen in 1974. Like I've been into the history of stand up for a long time.
Yeah.
But the basis of it came out of an article I wrote for Vulture magazine called The History of Stand-Up in 10 Moments or 10 Steps or something like that. And it did really well for them. It got hundreds and thousands of hits, and it was up there, and it was their number one article for a long time. But I started that article in 1947, and it went up till... I guess I did it 6 or 7 years ago to like 2000, whatever, 15 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then for some reason they took the article down, and then we were going to like redo it and update it, but it never happened. Mm. So so the article doesn't exist anymore. It's not online. I thought it was, people really enjoyed it.
Yep.
Since then I had learned a lot about Artemus Ward, which I learned about through, he's the guy that kind of inspired Mark Twain to perform. And I learned that through a comedian named Rich Scheidner, who has written a couple incredible books and a real comedy nerd like myself. And so I was like, oh, let me expand this out. And then when COVID hit, I was like, let me just write this whole thing and publish this book. And so that's what it is. So a lot of it is off the top of my head. I also teach at USC. So I would say 80% of the book, 85% of the book's off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. The other 15%, because of USC, I was able to access through their library system a bunch of resources that I never Nexus searched and all of that stuff.
Sure, of course.
That you would never, or you'd have to pay $500 a year or some crazy thing like that. So. Mm-hmm. So I'd say 15%, I double checked dates, I did a thing, that was new research that I did that I don't, and if it was ever like out of a book, I quote it right in the book. I don't do end notes, but it was like there was stuff about Richard Pryor I never knew, but that came from that Richard Pryor book. There was stuff about Burt Williams. I don't know if you guys ever did Burt Williams stuff here, like that out of that book. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know the record Cohen on the Telephone from 1913.
I do, yep.
Yeah, so that, I was like, I think it was the first million selling comedy record, and then I found a source for that. So I put, that guy has a book like that. So if it was a specific piece of information, I would source it. But for the most part, off the top of my head, and I just double check dates and things like that.
Yeah.
Is that too long a boring answer?
No, it was the kind of answer I was looking for, very specifically.
Okay. Yeah.
We can go back to Hole's Mellow Rolls if you want for a minute. Do you have a favorite bit off of this record?
Yeah, the Sullivan bit is same. It's next level. And he's just great on it. And he does the Sullivan impression, and obviously that has a, if you're into, it's not really in the history of stand-up, but in the history of impressionist, it's like a really phenomenal story, because there was a guy named Will Jordan who sort of created it.
Mm-hmm.
And impressions are like, how would you describe it, Josh? It was like figuring out the code of a lock, like figuring out the combination of the lock. Like,
yeah, I was looking somebody, at it as like finding an algorithm for somebody's voice.
Yeah. So, So once one person does it, you're like, oh,
yeah.
Oh, a lot of people can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So of course he gets incredibly embittered when Jack Carter does it, and what so it's, oh, and then he loses his ability to create a new impression because he has PTSD because everyone stole his last one. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't even want to come up and try to, you know, do a, I don't know, I'm trying to think who would be a famous actor back then, like a Kirk Douglas or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a really, it's just shows you how sensitive comedians are.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, like, who's the, Christopher Walken. Like,
sure.
Like, there was nobody doing Christopher Walken, and then, like, two, and then, like, everyone was doing Christopher Walken, right?
And I remember recently, I feel like somebody told me that, like, oh, no, but before Jay Moore and Kevin Pollak, blah-bitty-blah was doing it. I don't remember who they said, but, like,
right.
So it's always a different history you hear.
So right, but it's the same kind of thing. It's like, what did you call it, Jace?
The, like, finding the algorithm for somebody's voice?
Yeah. So it's, so that was an interesting part of it. So here it is, Gabe Kaplan, 10 years later, 12 years after the impression is created, doing a Sullivan. And yeah, that was his big closer. That was really tremendous, tremendous.
I mean, it's good. I did the whole album, not the whole, but a lot of the album is an excuse for him to either do voices or impressions. Like, he just, he's like, yeah, I had this classmate who did, he'd then bust out a Groucho. No, you didn't. But I like hearing your Groucho, and your Groucho's good. Like, so it's fine. Do your Groucho. I like that it is, I don't mean this as a pejorative either. It's gimmicky like that, but I kind of enjoy it because his energy is good. You can't. He's got a very likable voice too. That's one of the things. He's a very likable guy, which is of course why you'd say, yeah, sure, play the teacher on this show. Why would you not watch this guy?
He was also in a few movies. There was a basketball movie he was in that I loved growing up. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the name of it now. I want to say can't be that. And then he was just, and then he became this insane poker fanatic.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And played poker and then did poker commentary for years. I think up until a few years ago was doing that.
Was the movie Fast Break?
Yes, Fast Break. Yes. Go. What year is that? That's all. I'm going to guess 75, 79.
Yeah. Like right at the end of Welcome Back, Kotter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kata, Mr. Kata. Yeah, and he would do those long jokes at the beginning of it in a like a Seinfeldian kind of way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Seinfeld used to, for a while, I don't wonder if in syndication, like, that's what got cut out for a lot of those.
But yeah, don't they always open with him doing a bit that sort of
maybe a little bit
sets up the show? Yeah.
Yeah. God, what a incredible success story that guy.
Uh-huh.
So, so again, that was my fifth album I wanted to do.
Yep.
I'm glad we got to do it, but it was, I mean, I did have the album. I listened to it and saw him live at the time. So
did you have him sign it?
Dude. No, I'm not one of those guys. I don't have people sign things.
That's
absolutely
fair. Yes. Yes. If they're here, you know, if I interview them.
So why are you ending this thing? Can we bring it back on you?
Sure.
Enough about Wayne and Plantation?
Because I mean, I love doing it, but it takes up so much of my time and does not pay me, and it has not turned into like a TV version or the book that I would like it to become, because, you know, I don't have representation. Like, people are like, I'd love to do this book. How many followers do you have on Twitter? And basically I might as well hang up at that point, because they don't care unless you've got thousands of followers. And I don't, I'm not good at tweeting. I just make things.
What would be the name of the book?
Oh, I mean, if it was a book on this, it would just be called Comedy on Vinyl, The History of Recorded Comedy, something like that, blah, 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 you know. Although, I couldn't really, you know, I could call it Comedy on Vinyl. It would, that would be technically disingenuous, because obviously it started out on wax or tin. Or
right, but fuck, people, you know? Yeah. That's, so if you wrote the book, would mm-hmm. you, would you exclude stuff that's not on vinyl, or like bootlegs of someone's concert, like the, that Richard the hard, Lewis thing?
Right. I mean, that's the hard part. Like, how the hell would I, because I would really actually want to dig into the history of recorded comedy. But I feel like if I was to make it stick to the podcast theme, it would end up being like a Taschen book. It would just be a bunch of, look at these pretty album covers, and here's some rough history of what happens, you know. Look at
right, them. Right. Like, isn't so, there, don't, isn't yeah. there like collector books like that have stand comedy records?
I'm sure there are. I mean, there's this book called Enjoy the Experience. It's all uh-huh. about vanity presses. And stuff like that is filled with really beautiful comedy, or not comedy, very beautiful record covers that are insane looking, some of them. But it'd be, it would, you know, a book like that would be good. But if it was the history of recorded comedy, then it would be hard to call it Comedy on Vinyl. But, you know.
Interesting. Yeah. What about now? I know you're into the Fire Sign Theater. Is that, yeah. Was that your Falcon's Maze into this whole thing?
No, not at all. I grew up not getting Fire Sign. My best friend actually loved them and tried to introduce me to them. I don't get this. I'm not listening to this anymore. My friend Jeremy Guskin said, hey, can I talk about this one particular record on your show? And I said, sure, I don't get Fire Sign, but let's give it a shot. And I listened to it. I'm like, oh, okay, kind of roughly get this. And as a result of that, I met Fire Sign's archivist. And because of him, I got Phil Proctor of the Fire Sign Theater. And then that's why I'm like, well, they're a really important comedy group. So let's just do album by album, the whole history of the group. So
that's incredible.
I just didn't want to let it go, you know?
Who was the guy that used to do, I'm blanking on his name right now, but he did those incredible albums. He would like make fun of like advertising and.
Oh, Stan Freberg maybe?
Yeah, Stan. I don't know why I can't think of his name. Yes. Yeah. So how important is he to your story and your...
I would say he's important to the overall story of Comedy on Vinyl. Like, again, he's not one that I grew up with. I grew up with, you know, very particular influences. It was either shit my mother passed me or stuff that, you know, was on cassette at the time, like Weird Al, that I or Cheech and Chong. I'm too young for Cheech and Chong to have been around there from the beginning, but my mom gave me, like,
Los
Carlin,
Cucinas.
Smothers Brothers... Dan's dad gave him Greatest Hit by Cheech and Chong, so we got a mix.
Yeah.
And then Weird Al and Billy Connolly tape that my parents had.
Oh, phenomenal. Right. Oh, yeah. We haven't even talked about all of those.
Good God,
guys.
He's a dream guest, honestly. He would be, geez, I don't know. I don't know how he is for interviews right now, but my God, that would be amazing. Because he was kind of the Carlin of Scotland. He had his own, he's very much like him and had a very similar evolution in terms of style. And I don't know. Smothers Brothers were probably like the most important out of the ones that we've talked about, I think, and I would kill to interview.
Didn't they have like put out like Greatest Hits Volume 2? Wasn't that their first Greatest Hits?
Yeah.
That's very smart. That was solid. Very smart. Solid. Is Purple Onion their first album though?
God, I forget this every time. It's my favorite. And
it
so
is?
And, yeah, it is. And I don't know why. I think it's because there are bits where I'm like, I didn't expect these, you know, milquetoast looking white guys to be getting risque at all. They get a little risque. You know?
They're incredible. Jack Benny really championed those guys. There's some great performances of him on the Jack Benny show.
I feel like them and like their generation of comedians at the very least were at least half responsible for keeping the awareness of those old sons of bitches out there. And good for them, because I feel like, you know, if they weren't Lucille Ball and had every moment they ever performed recorded and in perfect quality, there's a chance that some of those guys could have dropped off the map, you know.
Do you know about this new Jonathan Winters thing that's coming out?
I do. Just interviewed Dan Pasternak for it.
Okay, great.
And by the time this comes out, I guess it should already be out. But I'm excited to hear it. Or that's a lie. I've already heard it.
You have?
Yeah, he said.
Why are you lying to me? What else have you been lying about?
I want it physically. Here's the problem. I want the physical copy. And if they don't send me a physical copy, Dan Pasternak is dead to me. That's not true. Yeah, I'm excited for that. And again, it's one of those things where like there are all these comedians that I didn't grow up with, but grew up with knowledge of. And then because of this, people are like, oh, you should hear this record they did. And it's like, oh, well, they had a totally different, very weird career before I ever knew anything about them as a, you know, before I, like as an actor or whatever. Like Richard Pryor. I had no idea what his stand-up would be. I grew up with him as the toy, which is fucking terrible. Right. Not even the best of his work. You know, it's weird. His stand-up is fucking just, I don't know, nobody does anything like that. And it's mind-blowing. It's very good.
I love it. Well, this has been a are we done? Are we wrapping?
We are. I'm happy to wrap. We can wrap now. Yeah. That's fine. But why don't you tell
people? I can keep going. You know me. I can talk for hours. So I don't want to overstay my welcome.
No, you're not remotely overstaying your welcome. Is there anything else you want to? Are there any other stories? Maybe anything you couldn't include in the book or stuff that you don't feel like you're spoiling if you tell from the book?
Oh, I don't care about spoiling anything in the book. Let me think.
Something that might interest this particular audience.
Right. I'm trying to think about comedy on vinyl. Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of hard because it seems like those Red Fox albums are the first albums recorded live, but you know, there were some Bob Hope albums, but those were recordings of his radio shows in the 40s, right? Those monologues are him. So I feel like that Red Fox one, and again, I can't even get the right year. Is it 56? Is it the end of 55? No one knows.
Right.
Laugh at the Party is the name of the record. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm very interested in Tom Lehrer.
Yeah.
Because he put out a studio comedy records around that time, but not live. And then went back and re-recorded those songs live. And my favorite thing about them is where he recorded them. Because they're incredible. These are the ones from 59 and 60. The one he does at MIT and the other he does at Harvard. I mean, it is, think about it. And the crowds are so, they're so appreciative. It's really phenomenal. It's just phenomenal. And I just like the whoever the engineers were on those records, it's just spectacular.
Did you try, even though he doesn't interview, did you try and reach out to Tom Lehrer?
No. I really didn't do hardly any new interviews for this book.
Okay.
I mean, I have done this History of Stand-Up podcast a little bit, so I had interviewed some people, but this book is not like a bunch of quotes about what happened and who and stories and stuff. It's just a chronology of this happened, and then there was vaudeville, and then there was nightclubs, and then there was the Ed Sullivan Show, and you know, and then there was comedy clubs, and then there was the coffee houses, and then there was comedy clubs, and then I give a lot of just like real moments, like Bo Burnham's put out a song on YouTube, and that became more popular than thousands or at least hundreds of road comics over a weekend.
Yeah.
So we were suddenly, we're in a new era.
Yeah.
We are in, and which we're in this era right now doing a podcast.
Yeah.
Right, Jace?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, that's it. That's, I'm trying to think if there's any other early comedy recordings on vinyl. No, and it's weird. I mean, how do you deal with Cosby? What's been your?
I will say this: we've talked about him more than enough on the show to give him his due as a comedian,
right?
And since then, I've been like, look, guys, I'm not going to talk about these three guys, but pick whoever the hell else you want. Obviously, pending, because who knows what'll happen tomorrow, you know?
And I
have no interest A in talking about them, and B in like having to hear somebody defend them or be like, got to separate the art from the artist, which I happen to disagree with. I get it. Because, Bill Cosby's fucking hilarious. I get it. Those things are great. I'm pointing to where those records are and as they're going to be thrown out. But it's just one of those things. Yeah, it's I don't know.
Okay. We don't have to. Sorry I brought it up. You can cut that out of the podcast.
No. It's not. It's worth asking. There's nothing wrong with asking that question.
I mean, it's just because I feel like you're a historian on this stuff, and I just want to know how you feel about it.
Yeah.
And they know how you feel about it.
Yeah. I'm very much, you can't separate the art from the artist. I can absolutely accept how good his comedy is, but I will tell you my favorite approach here. I'll tell you this, my favorite approach ever to dealing with Cosby's comedy. It was Greg Fitzsimmons just flat out stealing his comedy and doing it on stage. Like doing Cosby bits blatantly is one of the funniest things I've ever heard of anybody doing. Funny. And that's good. That's a funny bit. Reclaiming it by somebody who's not a creep. You know, that's fun. Right. I enjoy that.
Oh, I guess you don't know Greg Fitzsimmons that well. Okay. Interesting. All right. You live and you learn. You live and you learn.
Sure, yeah. You got to learn these things.
Well, anyway, I just want to say I was thrilled to do this the first time. I am going to send you a book. You don't have to buy
thank
it.
You. That's
is that cool?
Yeah.
Because you've been so nice to me. And I love that you did the Victor Borger record. That meant the world.
That was fun.
And you let me talk about four albums instead of one. And mm-hmm. I know we kind of cheated, but I loved it. I loved it.
Thanks again, Wayne. Thank you all for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!